I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like I'm dreaming.
Because you're talking to me?
Yeah, because I'm talking to you. Actually, no, because we are about to meet one of my favourite artists. And since we started the podcast, we actually went very early on to Edinburgh, to Jupiter Artland, and we saw this incredible work, which was called Cafe Party. And it's an installation that you walk into. And it kind of blew my mind at the time. I think it was first commissioned in like 2017, and we just literally stumbled across it in 2018 while we were there in Edinburgh Festival, doing an amazing kind of episode about different parts of Edinburgh and the kind of cultural landscape there. And it was the most bombastic, what's the word, like it just had such a massive impact on me, and I wasn't expecting it. So we walked into this cafe, and the whole thing was an artwork, from like the tables to the walls, having murals all over them, and like even the plates and the crockery, and the whole thing was this kind of living artwork, you know. And it was just mind-blowing, and it stays with me to this day. And every time I go to Edinburgh, I always make sure I go and like have a coffee in that space, because
we've got pictures of us in front of it that we can actually post as well.
We do, and I find it so joyous. And today's guest is born the same year as myself, not you, Russ, but he was born in 1980 in Lausanne. And he's a figurative painter predominantly. But the thing that I love so much about him is he's taken painting into the world and into the dream world at the same time. So it's this kind of like very heightened, super kind of extraordinary reality alongside, you know, things that you might already recognize within painting, such as still life and representational kind of conventions. And he paints in all different materials, often like soft pastel. And he's been showing all over the world. So I'm pretty sure wherever you are, there is something he has done in the city you're living, because he's becoming a globally kind of successful and celebrated artist. And I've wanted him on the show, no joke, since 2018. So we finally got there in 2023. So thank you to our guests for coming on. We would like to welcome to Talk Art, Nicholas Party. Hi, Nick.
Hello, guys. I mean, what an introduction. Thank you so much. That I'm very happy to be here. I mean, I could be, you know, before that, but time's been passing. But, you know, I love the podcast. It's really awesome and very, very happy to be here.
Thank you. So this mural cafe installation at Jupiter Artland in Edinburgh, when did you make that so people can sort of picture it?
That's a good question. I mean, it sounds like I think it was probably, 2016 or 17, I will imagine. And that was amazing, because we painted the entire kind of cafe on site. So we kind of stayed there actually like for like a month, you know, and, you know, in the owner house. And, you know, they're amazing hosts, a great kind of family. There's like, you know, peacocks around and like, you know, cooking great stuff. And we had like a fantastic time. My kind of wife now that came, and it's actually where I met Sanya Kantarovsky for the first time, and we became friends. They came with their little baby at that time. Anyway, that was an amazing memory. Actually, I had a great memory, because we stayed there for like, I think my wife's parents came to visit. Anyway, we had a great time. It's a great place. Yeah, it's really like fantastic. Yeah. And it's really fun to walk around this kind of sculpture park. There's a lot of great surprises to discover along the walk.
And Jupiter Artland is founded by Nikki and Robert Wilson, who are literally the greatest philanthropists in the UK, in my opinion. I love them so much because I feel like they put artists at the front of things, way ahead of everything else. It's like always the art and always the artist. They prioritize that. And their sculpture park, I mean, everybody just go. That's all I can say is please, please go. And I remember in that cafe, there was a whole series of paintings you did of like apples that had kind of like worms crawling out of them. I don't know why, but that's really sticks in my mind. I hope that's accurate.
I made that specifically for the space. I mean, yeah, they really wanted to do, you know, this full-on kind of cafe with like the plates and the tables. And so there was, I mean, there was a huge work to do actually. It took like a good year probably because all the tables are hand-painted and then there's a glass on top and we did the ceramics and we decided all the lamps and the bars and like even the design of the menu and everything. It was like it was a really great project. I will not do that every year because it takes a big chunk of your time.
Yeah, of course. But you do really, it by yourself. Really, you do it all by yourself. You don't have a team, or do you travel with a team now?
So when we did that, someone else came with me. We were two doing the murals, and actually all the there was this trompe l'oeil kind of malachite stuff on the table that was done with Sarah Magnetti, a friend of mine in Brussels, that's always been doing the kind of the four marble and four kind of effects on the different object that I've been doing. I mean, I don't really have a team of like mural or whatever because it's, I mean, at the studio it's a small, you know, like we only like four people, I guess, in the, but you can say like it's more than a lot of other studios, but it's less than some others. But because I paint everything, so I don't need anybody that it's not a production studio, right? So like if people have a big studio with usually sculptures, like we, if you have to do a lot of production with complex material, but because my studio is mainly painting, it's, you know, and I paint them myself, I don't need 10 assistants like painting my stuff. But when I do a mural, yeah, that's very likely that there's people around.
Got it. So we find you in New York right now.
Yes, I'm in New York, exactly. It's a beautiful February day. It's crisp and very sunny.
The perfect New York weather. But you, as Rob said, you were born in 1980 in Lausanne in Geneva in Switzerland, and you were literally born on a lake. This town is on a lake. I've done some research on it, and it's home of the International Olympic Committee headquarters. So was there a pressure... You've become an artist and you were born in Switzerland. Was there a pressure to go into sports if that's kind of like the Olympic center of the world?
Well, if there's one thing that Switzerland is not really famous for, it's sports, actually.
Oh, really?
It's too small. Well, you know, so they don't have really like, I mean, there's Roger Federer and there was a bunch of ski athletes at some points, but it's kind of small. So it's not really like, you know, like a big tradition of very famous athletes or like even the league, the football league or whatever. It's not like a huge thing.
Right.
But I mean, I think it's the Olympic thing is because it's neutral. There's also like the Red Cross, UNICEF. Because Switzerland has this very long history of being neutral, at least on the paper. So there's, you know, like after the Second World War, even before, there was a lot of kind of organization that is based mainly in Geneva, actually. But yeah, the Olympic kind of committee with all the things attached to its arc, it's based in, and there's a museum there that is, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I'm not a huge kind of Olympic kind of person, but it's something that is in Lausanne. I think what is actually maybe the most interesting thing for for us, like artist lover in Lausanne, is the Art Brut Museum. You know, like the kind of and basically like is the Dubuffet collection. You know, he was collecting kind of arts, and there's all those kind of different works.
Outsider artists and outlier
exactly,
artists, yeah.
Exactly, and he's the first one that collected them, you know, like a lot. And he basically he had this kind of relationship with this kind of doctor, and basically gave his entire collection in Lausanne, and they made the first kind of outsider museum. So basically the first outsider museum was in Lausanne, and it's like an incredible museum and an incredible resource. Now there's like museums like that more or less everywhere. But and there's like all the kind of the famous kind of Darger and like, you know, like all
Henry Darger, yeah.
Mm. Like famous kind of outsider artists that historical artists that are very well represented. And it's really, really an incredible place. It's like in this kind of old house. It's really and really incredible museums. That's really a special because Lausanne is obviously a small place. So this, but you know, Switzerland, because all the money tradition there, there's there's, you know, Basel, Zurich, they have incredible collections of art in the museums, and so Lausanne have a little bit of something. But
would you have, would this museum been open, this was opened in the 60s then, I take it, or 70s, this museum?
Yeah, I think they made the museum back then.
So as a kid, would you have gone there, and how did you find art in this town you grew up in?
Yeah, like that was typically like a school trip that you will do. Like you will go and you will be like, wow. Because, you know, I think for kids, outside art or folk art is definitely something that you can get pretty kind of directly. Like there's so much energy, so it's so direct. And there's maybe less the heavy skilled things that you kind of intimidated by or something. So that was like, yeah, that was an incredible, I have incredible memories. And every time someone comes into town, I'm saying like, you have to go. And often people are not disappointed. I'm not telling people to go to the Olympic Museum. Maybe I should. But
No. Do the buffet one. That's my choice.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic museum. It's really fantastic.
But how did you find art where you were from then? How did that come into your life and you realized that you wanted to pursue that?
Like every time I get asked this question of, like, you know, when an art is discovered, like, or when you kind of start to make art, I'm more like kind of answering in the back, not in the backward way, but like, I think like, you know, every children basically makes, like the children's life is very creative. Like you, the way you play, the way you interact with the world, with objects, it's, you kind of create walls all day long. And very often the first few years of education is basically creative. Like you make little, like, you know, obviously painting, collages, like little sculptures, but a lot of games that are very creative. You create, like, you know, you play like you're going to be a knife, you can be a knife, a knight,
a knife, maybe a fork. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's really incredible to witness. And I think like what's often happening is that while when you grow up, like most people just stop doing this, you know, as their main, you know, daily kind of, and artists, they just keep doing it. That's the only difference.
You never really grow up.
Yeah. You never really grow. And you feel comfortable enough doing that. And so you keep doing it. And if you're lucky, like I was during this kind of journey, like you get to do that all the time. But it's really not really a decision. You just keep doing it. And you're like, well, I guess I can do it.
You know, there's something about that as well that like inspires that kind of memory within adults who maybe are doing different professions where they're not using their creativity or their imagination as much, you know, if they like work in a bank or they work in, I don't know. I like that about artworks that actually like reinvigorate people's memory of childhood or play or fun. And when I first discovered your work around the time of Jupiter Artland, actually, I'd already seen a few paintings here and there, but it was at Russell's flat in London and he had a mirror that that has these two ears, and I think it's called Mirror with Snail. And it's a bronze actually, like the frame of the mirror is made out of bronze, but it's got this mirror inside, and it really reminded me of kind of like fairy tales and sort of like Cinderella
mirror on the wall.
The bad apple, like biting the apple, and those kind of things. But it was so fun. And also Russell's known for his trademark ears. His nickname is actually Ears, and and it was almost like a portrait of him. It was quite surreal when you looked in the mirror and you suddenly see these ears on the side. How did that work?
Try being me. That's my daily existence. Yeah, and it had like a snail on the top and like a little kind of like a caricature penis on the bottom. It all felt, I love it.
I made that mirror for the show I did in the Magritte Museum like a few years ago. Somehow like, yeah, I turned out to like do this mirror with like, yeah, the snail, the ears, and this kind of like handle that can be seen as a penis. that's kind of one of the kind of only object that I did like that. But I could actually talking about it make me feel like I should like do I love that little object. And it was very fun to have it in the Magritte Museum because, I mean, it echoes like this kind of surreal objects. He did like few sculptures. I mean, it was an incredible project because I had the chance to put my work in the museum. So, I mean, the project was actually kind of funny because there's the Magritte Museums in Brussels, and I was living in Brussels back then. And basically a bunch of paintings were going to Chicago, I think, or San Francisco. I think it was Chicago for like a big Magritte shows. So basically there was all those kind of empty slots on the museums. And they were like, oh, what are we going to do with that? And basically like asked me if I could like just basically fill the the holes where all the Magritte were missing. So that was like kind of and I was like, okay, that sounds amazing. And a little bit intimidating, obviously, but I just took it more as like a fun project. And I did almost all the paintings kind of really directly in connection with and I, that's why also I used like this trompe l'oeil and actually did a mural in the staircase that is still there.
But he must be, Magritte must be a hero for you because you definitely share this surrealism tonality that goes through all the practice. Is Magritte someone that you've looked to in your own work?
Yeah, like so there's a museum that is very dear to me in my hometown, Lausanne, that's called Fondation de l'Hermitage, which is kind of private foundation, but it's more like impressionist, but they do like kind of two shows a year, I think, but often the kind of big kind of shows. And basically my parents' kind of best friends were basically the kind of janitors of that museums.
Wow.
And they lived basically, and the wife was doing the cafe, and basically they had like a little almost cottage house, pretty amazing little house next to this museum on the hill. That's kind of, I mean, it's a beautiful place. And basically because my parents were friends with the people working, the janitors of museums, I was always going there and I was seeing all the shows, which was a big kind of part of my childhood because it was a park there, and basically I would go to see the shows. And there was a show, I think in 89 or something, a big Magritte show. And I remember, I grew up with the one of the poster in my kind of living room. My parents got the poster, and that was like an amazing. And there's a bunch of shows that I really kind of mark my childhood. But Magritte was, and then like, Magritte is such a big kind of figure, and then you go back and forth with it. And like when I moved to Brussels, like I went to the museums and I kind of discovered new works. I mean, I think like in the maybe 90s or something, there was a big rediscovery of the Période Vache, you know, when it's like, yeah, this kind of more expressive, kind of very strange kind of period of Magritte. I mean, when you go to see the Magritte Museum, actually, because it's kind of a chronological kind of hanging, you see it's a pretty amazing artist. Like, it's not only the very famous iconic images, which are really amazing, but he has a little bit of the curse of being used so much into merchandising and umbrellas and mugs that sometimes when you see the real painting, you're a little bit like, oh, that's the same one that I have on my mug. Nevertheless, they're great paintings. If something looks so great in the mug, that's at the start, it has to look very good on the canvas. But anyway, there's a lot of different things, and there's a lot of things that are less known that are really kind of really amazing, very creative, very funny. And this Belgium living, you know, I lived in Brussels for a few years, and this very strange, surreal humor is like very, very real there. I love it.
You've moved around a lot because I met you in 2019 in Glasgow, and you did your BA in Switzerland in your hometown, and then you did your MFA at Glasgow. What was it that brought you to Scotland then to do that? What was it about the school in Glasgow that was the big pull for you?
Yeah, that was always the question. I was like, why are you in Glasgow? Like, from Switzerland? Like, but you should.
Why not? I mean, one of the schools in London. What was it about the Glasgow school?
Yeah, that was like, Paris, London, I guess, Berlin. I mean, schools were maybe less kind of like known then, but for sure, like Paris and London were the main kind of. I mean, what happened is like, I asked one of my tutor, like Philippe de Croza, like an artist from my hometown, and he told me, like, he literally told me, oh, like this, and it was in, I guess, in 2001 or 2 or 3 or whatever, like when this I heard that. And he told me, oh, there's like this great gallery, the Modern Institutes, and he followed like a bunch of artists. He was from this generation of like Jim Lambie and John Tatum and Thomas Sullivan and Martin Boris. And he said like, oh, there's this great gallery like early 2000 and there's a great school. And I guess I was just very like, listened to my tutors, where I was like, oh, okay, he's not even much older than me, maybe like 6 years older. And, but you know, at school, like whatever, like when you're a kid and you're like, if your teacher that you kind of like respect, admire, like whatever they say, you're going to be like, okay. So I said like, oh, I guess I need to go to Glasgow. And I applied once, I got rejected, and I didn't apply to anywhere else. It was very strange. I applied this, you know, Glasgow, like they said no for the first time. And then the second year I reapplied and they said yes. And I went there. And so that was the first. And that's kind of, I mean, I wanted to leave Switzerland. That was very clear to me because I somehow also I knew that I had to kind of, I wanted to learn English. I wanted to kind of see things around. And when I moved to Glasgow, like after like 2 years of school, like the big thing was to not coming back, because it was, you know, Switzerland is very comfortable. Like, obviously, like, it's easy to find a teaching job, or like, you know, like the whole system is pretty kind of comfortable for like a middle class kind of white guy like me. Like, if you Glasgow for me, like, after school was very kind of hard in a way, because like finding little jobs, I mean, it was kind of little, it was much harder for me, you know, like my English was not great. And but anyway, I, you know, like as many others, like I kind of struggled a little bit, and I stayed for 6 years, and that was long enough to be like, okay, I'm not going back to Switzerland. Because most of my friends that left Switzerland after school, especially Berlin or Paris, they all came back after a few years, because it was like, well, jobs are much better in Switzerland, we still have friends there. And I was like, I mean, anyway, it was in my personal life and career was a huge thing to be like, you know what, I need to cut it out. To like the comfort of Switzerland need to be like removed.
How did you cope with the rejection of being turned away in the first year? You know, if you were planning to go Glasgow, you'd set yourself up and they said no for the first year. How did you keep the focus?
It was kind of okay, I guess, because I had a girlfriend then, and it was actually, you know, it was a good relationship. So it was like kind of almost relieved. It was like, okay, I can like still stay here. And also at that point, we were like, it was, I guess, then a year after art school, and we had like an art space in Switzerland. We opened a gallery. We were organizing concerts in all the post-art school shebang. It was super fun. So actually, like the 2 years or 3 years after art school, I stayed in Switzerland because I got rejected. It was actually kind of a blessing, because I had to really kind of live a really amazing kind of, you know, like kind of bohemians, like in a context, because the bohemian in Glasgow was slight, it was definitely a little bit rougher for me anyway, because Glasgow is slightly, you know, like it could be sometimes a little bit difficult.
Just a nice way of putting it. Yeah.
When you were in Scotland, did it kind of introduce you to any types of art or artists that you weren't familiar before? Because I know there's like a rich history there of kind of different Scottish artists.
I mean, what was the huge revelations when I moved to Glasgow I was kind of young in my mid-20s, and was to discover, because it was the MFA, right? And it was people from everywhere, people from the US, people from Scandinavia, from Asia, from different places in Europe. And it was interesting because everybody came with their own set of reference that they thought everybody should, there was, you know, they were the big deal artist. And I was the same. I was like, I did my art school with a bunch of teachers telling me like, well, this is like really an important artist and this is what it is. And, you know, like, and I discovered that everybody had that same, and I was like, oh, actually there's millions of, there's all those different people coming with their very set of reference that they feel is like, oh, if you know, like the classic, do you know, like this artist? And it was like, no, it's like, really? I mean, he's super famous. And it's like, and you never heard about him, right? And I found it like really a big relief. I was like, oh, so that means there's so much to discover and there's like all those different. And I feel like every time you travel to a country, like to a museum, every country has their famous artists, right, that are usually known. And the US is the same. People think it's like, it's the famous, you know, like, oh, if you make it in New York, you make it anywhere. That's completely not true. Most of the artists that are very known in the US, especially market-wise, absolutely have, nobody knows them in Europe.
Yeah,
they never had shows or anything. Every art scene is fairly, in a way, local. So you have to go to places to discover those amazing kind of artists, because there's always hidden gems everywhere.
I know, it's endless. I think that's why we love doing talk art. I remember after the first season, someone was like, oh, you must be done now. Like, you've interviewed everyone there is to interview. I was like, do you have any idea? Like, I discover artists daily via Russell Tovey. It's never going to end. Also, right now you have an exhibition in
Brussels,
in Brussels, in the place where you were living, at Xavier Hufkins, who's an amazing gallerist who's shown some of the greatest artists ever. Like, he was one of the champions for Louise Bourgeois way before anyone else was championing Louise's work. So your show is called Cascades and it runs through to March. And in that show, there seems to be lots of connections to other historical artists. Like, my favorite artist ever is Hieronymus Bosch, and I've done the pilgrimage to Madrid and seen the Earthly Delights installation, which blew my mind. Can you talk a bit about this new show and these connections to history, in particular the triptych? I know that's like a important thing.
Yeah, I do love, I mean, I think like a lot of artists, but I look at art a lot, and I really look at it not with in an academic way, more like as a very intuitive, passionate love, where like if I see something that I love, I look at it. Sometimes I go deep-ish in it, never like super deep by reading like, you know, 15 books about it. And like I think in the show in Brussels, it's very actually connected to the last show that I did there, where I kind of, it was loosely based on this kind of Flemish painter called Jean van Kessel, which is, you know, basically like it's, you know, Bosch or Bruegel, all this kind of 1600s kind of Flemish golden age of paintings. And he was painting all those kind of insects, basically. It's when like science and art was kind of merging a bit, and some artists were like very much involved in both sides. Like they were like using the tools, you know, like the magnifying glasses and like really doing painting animals and research that were basically they were doing at the same time, scientific illustrations and paintings. And Jean van Kessel is one of those very interesting artists. Another artist that I love, it's Otto Marcus van Schrik. I mean, they're a little bit obscure artists, but nevertheless, very cool artist from kind of that area. And turned out that Jean van Kessel was doing a lot of paints on copper. Copper was like a material that was used for many reasons, but because it was very hard and flat, so very soft for detail painting, very small detail painting, insects typically, or like very little still life. Actually, Bruegel did a bunch of those, like very small landscapes. It was very good. Also, they were reusing basically the back of like etching plates often. So they were kind of recycling kind of material, and it was kind of easy to prepare. And from basically my little like journey into those kind of little like artists, I started to kind of try to paint on copper, and I tried, and because I kind of stopped oil painting when I did pastel, and I kind of wanted to come back to it, and so that was my kind of way back. So it's my kind of way back into oil painting. And so they're very small little oil paintings mixed to the, and they're very kind of directly connected to the, to this kind of golden age of Flemish painting. And the cabinets are also very kind of connected to the tradition of the altar, the church altar, that is there's a heavily presence in the Flange, in Orleans, all those kind of very famous kind of Van Dyck triptych and so on. And I kind of did the triptych first in Italy, like really referring an object in one of those also like historical museums. So anyway, the show in Brussels have all those kind of little connection to those objects.
And the animals that you've chosen to reference, or the nature elements within the show, because there's obviously like bats appear, or like seahorses, which are my favorite ever. I love that.
Snails? Is there snails in
and
this
snails,
one?
Yeah, the snails return just from your mirror. They've like crawled along and ended up in the painting.
Brussels.
But can you talk about the significance of these particular like
motifs.
Elements of nature and motifs? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think about my little family of motifs, like some of them like come and go, sometimes they stay much longer. I'm kind of, I approach them really as a symbolist kind of almost approach, but without like using really one particular kind of side of the meaning of whatever symbols have been used in the past. So what I love about the snail or the bat or the seahorse. Seahorse has been used a bit less than, let's say, a snail or like a shelf. It's those kind of objects that have been used in literature, in arts, and human creation in Western culture and other culture that I'm less familiar for like thousands of years. And what I love is like by just taking that object, let's say like a seashell, like you basically almost like take the entire history of how it's been used symbolically, and you don't really have to decide where you want this object to go, but you know that everybody's gonna come with their own kind of
projection.
And they're very, very kind of charged, powerful symbols. So like I'm trying always to find a balance of making them like very clear what they are, and like not being shy of like, oh, a shell could represent this and this and this for people, but also I'm trying to leave them open so you know where I see like a lot of things, but it's towards my personal kind of, you know, like knowledge of what I've been reading, what I've been looking, and everybody like comes with their own, you know, maybe you read something a week before and you're like, oh, I'm connecting this bat to this, or like, you know, there's all those. And that's kind of really what I like about those kind of symbolic kind of elements.
I guess they
they stand for what they are. There's not really a hidden meaning. It's not like hieroglyphics. Mm. They are what they are for you.
Exactly. And what they are, it's this basically history of symbolism in human cultures. That's I really accept it and happily use without, you know, I'm not shy about, like, you know, what could be the symbolic of all those objects. I kind of really like it. If I paint a sun or I paint a tree, I'm not saying that will be my un-American way of painting a sun. I'm not like, oh, it's because it's a circle and it's interesting formally. Like, if I paint a sun, it's because it's what symbolizes, you know, like a sunset, let's say. I use quite often this idea of the sunset. If I paint a sunset, it's not just because it's making nice colors. I really believe that if we love looking at a sunset, it's because we actually witness something very special at that particular moment. Mm. And it's not just because, oh, it's pink and we like the color. It's because it's the only time that you actually witness the movements of Earth during the day. Like right now, if I look at outside, I don't feel like I'm moving. The Earth is moving. But during the sunsets, especially if it's you at sea, you actually see the movement like right in your eye. Like you can see it's like it's turning. And that is like, I mean, it's kind of mind-gobbling if you think about it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to think about it too much, really. Sometimes it does get a bit too existential.
But I like that. So, like, if I paint a sunset, of course, like, there's, you know, like, the all the formal aspects, I love playing with it, but I really also want to embrace that aspect to it.
Yeah. Well, people coming to your work will see these landscapes, the sunsets, the trees. They will see a lot of still lives. There's a lot of fruit appears in your work, a lot of pears. I love the pears. They look like little sad penises at some point. I love that. A lot of portraits, but they're all rendered in, and you mentioned it briefly, in soft pastel. And you must get through truckloads of pastel. But when did you know that pastel was your best friend?
I mean, the first time I used it was very strange because before in Glasgow, I was doing a lot of oil painting and I was very slow with it. And it was a little bit frustrating because I was taking sometimes 5 months, 6 months, and I was layering, changing composition, changing colors constantly. And I was, you know, not really moving fast enough in my feeling. And so like I was really, I think, trying to find another medium to just like, you know, like break something in my practice. Like, I mean, you will have from a lot of art, sometimes you're a bit kind of stuck and you need to have something kind of, so you want to move on. We're not here forever, right? So you can, if you want to explore things, you need to kind of move on. And I saw this show of Picasso from, you know, it's not really a pastel artist or even an artist that I kind of revere or whatever, but I just saw like a pastel of his, a little portrait. It's kind of post-cubist kind of period when it's like a bit Botero-esque. It's like very roundy and like kind of very rendered. And he used pastel and he did this portrait, kind of also very influenced by kind of Greek sculptures. And I literally like, oh, I want to do exactly the same thing. And you know, I mean, I'm a person that if I see a painting that I love, I just literally want to do the same one, and I literally do it. I just go and if it's too similar, I don't really mind. I'm like, well, this is if I couldn't like bring novelty, well, this is my fault. But you know, that's it. And so, but I bought the postcard, and I went the next day. Like, you know, I bought some pastels and some paper, and I kind of started to copy that postcards, and that's the kind of the first portraits. And like the first thing that I did, the first one, so it's kind of funny because I look at this postcard and I started to add makeup to the kind of high shadows and like lipstick,
yeah.
And and it kind of came like kind of out of nowhere. And for like almost 2 years, I was always doing that. And it's only after that I discovered that this particular medium has a very kind of close relationship to makeup. And so there was something very kind of natural for me to investigate with the portraits, my relationship with gender, with makeup, with what is a face, how you define, you know, masculinity or femininity, and which was again like very naturally driven to the history of this particular medium in the 18th century with the Rococo, and just very briefly the at that time, everybody wear like tons of makeup. Basically, everybody was covered, like in the high kind of the people were portrayed. Basically, this white powder, this like pink kind of, you know, like
rosy cheeks. Yeah,
yeah. The wigs with like powder on it. So when you were painting, basically a person, you were painting a painting. You know, you were like basically, and you were using pastel, which was basically made from the same material. Like the vendors that were selling pastel were selling makeup too. You can imagine that the rendering of a pastel next to the actual people were like, wow, this is really the same thing. It's literally
the
both wearing a mask.
Yeah. The same surface, same surface texture. I like the fact that there is an androgyny in your work. Like, you do have these. It is just like an exploration of gender. And it is historical as well, what you're saying. It also tips into like an alien quality that the characters have. You know, there is an androgyny, but they do feel non-human at times, and their eyes are quite wide at points, and they're like staring directly at you. Is that something also that you've been aware of and really like channeled?
Yeah, I think like when and probably like most artists do the same, when you start to work, you kind of go on a journey to investigate something that you don't know about the work and yourself. So I think most artists don't go like they don't go in the studio painting thinking like, oh, I want to express that and I know how to do it. And, you know, in 5 days, I'm going to finish the painting and that will be exactly said what I plan to set. Like, you usually go and you have no idea and you're kind of trying to go with the painting inside yourself, asking you questions. And you do, for example, those characters, what I wanted to do is to spend time with them. And when I paint them or when I look at them, I'm with them and we have a conversation and I ask them things, they ask me things, and we hang out during
what
the day.
What do you ask them? What do they ask you? And how many characters do you have? Do you have like a family now that you go back to every time, or does suddenly a new child appear?
I think it's more or less the same person, you know. Okay. Like, it's kind of sometimes say like portraiture is like always some sort of an extent of yourself, and it's you exploring different sides of yourself that that you maybe don't explore in your real life, but with art, you know, it's like in any fictions or anything creation, very often you explore a character that's you can't explore in your daily life for whatever reason, and in your art you can, you know, like if write murder stories, like you can create like all those characters. Mm. Every character that a novelist creates is kind of themselves in a way. Like, they always say, like the famous Tintin, like Hergé, like every Hergé was every character in the book, basically. It was
he created them all, so they all came from him. But they're all exactly, very, they're all very confident. Your characters, they're always either connecting with you directly. They're never shying away. They're never, you know, if you see them from behind, you might be seeing their bum. And they're aware you're looking at them. There is a real confidence that goes through the portraiture, especially for the characters. They're not humble. They're very almost cocky, almost saying, come on, stare at me.
Yeah, performative.
Yeah, performative.
Yeah, I think they're like they're staring very strongly, and they have a very strong presence also because of the colors and like kind of their attitudes. They're like, you know, they don't really have much vulnerability or emotions.
Yeah, they're not vulnerable. They're not vulnerable at all. No.
But they're also kind of like not present. I feel like they're a little bit like they have a presence that is almost like kind of behind you. Like they feel a bit like a facade, like a mask that is very, very strong. But actually behind that, it's kind of like we don't really know what is there. Because of the Rococo, the makeup and the mask, but also like the reference to especially Greek, more than Roman sculpture, where like the face is like a very idealistic face. And it's also like kind of a, you know, like an aesthetic of strength or an aesthetic that is not realistic. When Roman sculptures is bringing that much more than Greek sculptures. Like, and I felt like in our contemporary world, I think maybe I was, and I'm still influenced by the social media, or like the present, the filters, you know, the Photoshop figure that is also like a little bit of that presence that is, or the 3D kind of, you know, like most of the movies now, like half of the characters are
like a CGI
real
quality sort of thing.
Yeah. And so they have like this very strong presence, but behind them, it's kind of like, it's just nothing. It's like kind of, so maybe there's a bunch of that in them.
I think about that actually, when you think about your sculpture. So when did the series of heads and busts like start to appear, because you also, as well as making these like 2D paintings, you make these kind of giant busts, which are often even bigger than, you know, they're huge, aren't they, of these heads. Like how did that body of work appear? Because that seems connected. And
these are made with paint, aren't they? They're not pastel, these ones.
No, those are painted, exactly. Those are oil painted, yeah. I think it's like what happened is that because I was looking, I think, a lot of Greek sculptures when I was doing those portraits, I guess I was naturally drawn to be like, oh, it could be fun to do a kind of a bust or something. And I think like the first that I did was in Oxford, in Modern Art Oxford. And so I wanted to make most of the work not a sculpture, but a painting, but still be an object. So like the shape of the heads was a very generic. So I think I only had two shapes. The one is the first one is at the Oxfords, and they have it's slightly different than the new ones. And then I did like a few different shapes with different cuts. But if it's not painted, it's really not. I will not say it's a very interesting form. It's really like a doll or like a kind of mannequin type head. It's very kind of they don't really have any character. When they're painted, they become something that is kind of that has a little bit more of a personality or a character. But so that was kind of the idea, was really to try to find a way to have those presence that I have in the pastel, but in the space, which it's, I always kind of wanted to have a little bit of objects in my practice, even if I really not a sculptor and I'm really pretty terrible actually at modeling or whatever. Like I'd love to be better, but like it's hard. But when you do shows, it's really fantastic to have objects. Like if you only have paintings, it's actually kind of hard to do, especially if you do, and I love doing shows, so I do usually quite a lot of shows during the year. And if the space is big, if like there's different rooms, if you have objects, it saves you a day, because only hanging painting can be hard. It can be like a little bit dry and a little bit kind of, I mean, in my, just in, that's personal, like in, because I want to have fun when I install shows and I want to have a journey of excitement making it.
There is a lot of fun and humor that goes through all your practice. And these giant heads are on these kind of marble plinths, but they're Trump loyal. And you mentioned that a couple of times, and I would love for people listening, because I only really discovered what it meant a couple of years ago.
Isn't it Loy, babe?
Trump Loy. Well, Loy. I can't even say it right. There you go. I don't
Trump
even know.
Loy.
It's because of a message. Oi, Trump Loyal.
Trump Loyal.
Trump Loy. Yeah.
It's so Trump Loy.
The first time I came across it was.
It's more like Oi.
Trump Loy was Gavin Turk had made something called Hobo, which looked like someone in a sleeping bag, but it's made out of bronze. And I didn't realize until later on that the term for it was Trump Loy. So what is Trump Loy, and how did, historically, what is that, and how did that come into your practice, and why is that important?
Yeah, I mean, it's so the term trompe-l'oeil is in French, means, you know, oeil is the eye, and tromper is cheating. So it's like cheating the eye. That's what it means. And the term actually is a kind of early 1800s term. This was actually created by an artist, Boilly, that's kind of sticked from that. But obviously, Trompe-l'oeil kind of, and Boilly actually, it's also an artist that I love, that I did a show in Dijon, the consortium, very based on his, like a great also artist that is not super well known from the kind of 1800. Anyway, but he did great Trompe-l'oeil, as you can, like basically like the, at that time, what is kind of known is like the back of canvas is painted, you know, like you see like what you feel is the back of again of this old trompe-l'oeil, and there's like also all those kind of like bands with like kind of postcards and like notes, dollar bill. But the trompe-l'oeil history is very as old as art almost. Like it's, you know, like think about, the main thing is think about just the Renaissance, like there's literally painted marble and painting architecture that is like painted everywhere. And there's, I think there's obviously like the symbolic and the metaphors of what is a trompe-l'oeil, and especially like with the invention of perspective, what's, you know, perspective is obviously a tool to create and gimmick a space, but it's also like a metaphoric kind of space that goes very directly in tight with what in the Renaissance religion and humanists are trying to tell about what is God and what is, and the perspective is like really like an extension of this world into like a spiritual world. which is very different than the flat world of that is kind of different, like from before. And so basically the trompe l'oeil is also like very used in the churches to basically like the marble is very, very specific for that, because having curved marble is very expensive and very complicated. So if you can paint it, like basically if you see any kind of churches, like usually 30% at least is painted. You don't sometimes notice it, but it's everything that is curved usually is painted, because it will be so expensive and complicated to cut slabs like curved that they're painted. And also columns, sometimes they're painted because it will be like super expensive to have those like big block of marbles. And so I loving all those kind of fun geekiness about history of art and all those kind of difference, I started to do trompe l'oeil marble when I met my, like I met when my friend Sara Magnetti went to Brussels to basically study at the Van der Kellen Institute, which she kind of went because Lucy Mackenzie, another Glaswegian artist, great, fantastic artist that used trompe l'oeil a lot in her practice. So she basically, Sara Magnetti, this friend from Switzerland, loved her work. She's like, I want to go to the school that she did to learn that that skill. And it's basically the most interesting school. It's basically 1 year, and they learn like 20 woods and 20 marbles. They have like white gowns. They have to put their phones on little baskets. They don't put the eating on. It's like the most old-fashioned school you can ever imagine. It's like run by the same family, the Van der Kellen. And basically, like after like those this year, you know how to do it. And so like when she was doing it in Brussels, and I started to see it, which was like, oh my God, this is so cool. Like, can you come to do a, you know, like, can you do use your skill for one of my show? And she was like, yeah, that's, she wanted to learn it from her, for her practice, but also she wanted to learn it to basically like use it in different decorative kind of projects or different artists. So we did a show in Cannes Neuchâtel, a museum in Neuchâtel in Switzerland. That was the first time we used it. And that was like, yeah, amazing. Also like kind of love for this kind of technique and working with her was great. So then I did, I think, the Hammer Museum. I used it a lot, actually, like still to this date. Also, it's an amazing part of doing mural because I don't do it. So it's Yeah, so most of the murals I do it, and it's sometimes it's a bit taxing because it's, it takes so much time. It's very physical. So like one, so it's one part of the mural that I don't do. So it's like really sometimes like, oh great, so that part of the mural
is covered.
Like the, that's like
so you do as
produced,
much
right?
as possible with trompe l'oeil, basically.
Yeah,
you know, it's funny because I always think about Martin Margiela as well with trompe l'oeil, because I feel like he took that into a fashion context from Belgium. There seems to be like always this fascination from Belgium as well, and obviously like I guess Magritte and
Magritte has a lot of trompe l'oeil, a lot of it.
Because that's actually where I first ever saw trompe l'oeil. I think is in the Magritte painting. I remember it as a child.
Well, he does all those objects, you know, like the bottles made out of stones, or like you know, like there's all those kind of things that are like the. And it's basically, yeah, very heavily put it in the kind of history of trompe l'oeil.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
It's a good way of like opening your mind, isn't it, to like a different reality.
Yeah, no, it's at the end, like art is, there's a lot about magic and trickery and like, you know, how the viewer loves to be kind of cheated, you know, like, you know, you know you're getting cheated. So, you know, a magic trick is always that, you know, it's a magic trick, but nevertheless you love, you know, like,
and there's like a joy, isn't there, like a pleasure.
Yeah, and you know, like some arts, but painting is very heavily based on that, because you know it's flat and you know it's, you know, nothing else than just a few marks of paint, but you still play the game of being like, wow, this is actually a landscape. You know, it's not a landscape, it's a bunch of like marks of paints.
I always felt that with photography as well. Like, there's certain contemporary photographers, even like if you think of really obvious ones like Sugimoto, but where you see the kind of like repeated like horizon lines, there's actually something so pleasing about it, because it's almost like a moment of calm and serenity, that when you are stood in front of a sea and you see that for yourself, you will go, oh, lovely. And but you're sort of capturing that, and then you get to hang it in your house, or you see it in a museum, or and then it constantly creates that kind of like emotion of serenity in just through like the window of the photo. And I felt like that in your show at Xavier Hufkins currently in Belgium, like those horizon lines, it's such a kind of pleasing thing. And it's in both pastel but also in oil, where you do it over and over again within that show, this kind of like horizon that's almost like floating, and it feels like you're being pulled into it, like the edge of a waterfall or something, like it's about to drop off. It's really seductive.
Yeah, but that's a very good way to put it. And it's because the show called Cascades, you know, basically it's waterfall. Yeah. So there's this idea of like, you know, like a waterfall is this moment where there's obviously an edge, and like the gravity and the quality of what water is just like falling. And there's, you know, a long kind of, again, it's a theme and a subject that is, there's a long tradition, actually, especially in Asia, like it's a very loved kind of a theme. But again, like there's so much that you can project on, you know, the what is water, what is like this cut into the lens, like, and it kind of crashed and this evaporates and is connected to life, to the connected to things that are kind of passing. And that's what I love about all those kind of subjects. Like, you can, you know, horizon is the same thing. It's like, you know, it's the line, it's what you see, the curve of Earth. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. Like, it's the famous scene in the you know, like in when they discover, like they see a boat kind of, you know, disappearing, and they're like, this is strange. And then you realize, oh, it's actually curved. Again, it's like it's only when you're at the sea and you see the horizon on the sea that you can understand that the Earth is actually like, I mean, now with a plane, it's maybe you can see a little bit too, but back in the days, less. And that I love those kind of things. And because like, I love the idea that art brings you with the trickery, the seduction of colors, the sensuality of shapes, and, you know, like really kind of like seducing your eyes and like flirting with you and like pulling you in that little room, this square. And then like, if the person wants, can go like, you know, very far into like great extent of you know, existential kind of questions. Or not, but
again, terrifying questions, especially if you're drunk and lying on your back in a field looking up at the stars. that always a very scary moment you can possibly bring on yourself. So when I met you in 2019, it was at the Modern Institute Gallery through Toby, who runs that, who is a legend. And since then, you have now got 6 galleries that you are represented by, and that's a lot of galleries, Nicholas. How does that work with scheduling, with demand for work? Because you're very commercially, like internationally successful, you're critically successful, there's a lot of, you know, you do a lot of exhibitions and museum shows, and you're like top of the game. Do you feel a responsibility to give work to every gallery, and how do you do that? Do you work towards exhibitions, or do you constantly make work outside of a body of work for a show? What is your life like, your studio practice like?
So the studio, the artist life of me right now, it's very professionalized in a way. Like, but in a, my part is very good, because I come to the studio, but I need to work a lot to do all these projects. So I need to come every day and like, you know, work pretty seriously of you know, in terms of I can just like, I don't get a lot of studio visits typically. Like, I'm just coming here and I work kind of a lot to be able to do all the shows. Because the thing is, the reality is, like, I've always, as many of our friends, artists or friends, you know, like having shows is what you want. You kind of, and every time someone asks you something, you always feel extremely kind of grateful and lucky. You feel like, oh, amazing, someone wants to, and it's, you never take it as granted, like, oh, again, like, you know, you've always, and it's impossible to say no. Someone wants to do something, it's amazing. It's like, you know, like it's what I've been wanted all my life. And I also know so many of my friends, they don't get that many shows. The only thing they want is to get shows. I will feel terrible to say like no to anything. Of course, sometimes scheduling is hard, but always knew that at some point, you know, things slow down, you get older, whatever, like you know, you get less demand. But when you have a lot of people asking you, like, I feel it's kind of almost a duty to say like, sure, I'll do it, you know, and I'm going to work as hard as possible to every time make the most interesting show that I can, you know, like sometimes it's not great, but hopefully, you know, it's good. It's good sometimes. And the gallery was a bit of a similar thing. Like every time, you know, a gallery came to ask me to work with me. I mean, I think more or less, I mean, maybe that's a slight lie, but it's more or less all the galleries that I work with, the people that ask me, there's maybe one or two other ones that I said no at the end. But, you know, like there was the Monet Institute and there was Gregor Steiger and then there was Kaufman Repetto and then there was Karma and then there was Xavier Hofkins and then Hauser and Wirth. So I think people sometimes will think like, oh, like you had like a lot of demand. No, there was actually more or less it was always just this person. I never got like 10 people asking me and I had to choose between 10. It was only one, and I'd say, okay, that sounds amazing, and it was always a great relationship. Of course, at the end, when Hauser, much bigger gallery, like, and there was five other galleries, the idea was probably to scale down, you know, to make this entire operation a little bit like more practical. But I felt like it was too hard to kind of cut tight with those amazing partners that I've been working with. You know, like every partners provide you something different. Of course, you build up friendship. It becomes obviously much more than work, because if you work a lot, like as you know, like your friends becomes your kind of work partners.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, become family and everything. Absolutely. It's like a wedding, exactly. Isn't it? It's like a marriage, going into it.
It is a little bit, and you know, like you start to grow up together, like people have kids in the same time, and it's you start to be like, well, it will. So I always feel like, well, I can just try to basically make all this. I use my very Swiss diplomatic skills to make this. And it's not easy every day, but it's possible. But sometimes, I guess twice a year, I need to have like a big kind of strategic kind of discussion with everybody to everybody at peace.
Well, of course, because people listening might not realize or do realize that when it comes to selling art, the artist will traditionally get 50% of the price of the artwork, and then the gallery will get 50%. But then some artists have a main gallery who might get a percentage cut of that work wherever it's shown. So I guess it's down to your studio manager. You probably step away from it now to negotiate all of those little cuts to all the galleries now, because I'm sure there's people that, you know, you get your cut.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's what happened with when I first started to work at the Monet Institute. There was this kind of because it was my first gallery for a few years. They were taking 10% of the sales. That's what happens a lot. And then we remove that, and now everybody's exactly the same. It's very simple. It's kind of like everybody get 50, 50, 50, 50, and there's no like. Strange. I mean, my situation is very, in a way, very simple, but it just require like, you know, a little bit of talk here and there. And like, but you know, at the end of the day, like everybody's working toward the same goal. All those galleries have a lot of artists, and you know, like everybody's like trying to make good projects. And if it's, you know, I've been so fortunate and so lucky to have such great opportunities that I feel like everybody should just be like, oh, this is great, and just let's
exactly.
Keep,
and it all feeds each other. I think people need to stop being so sort of protectionist, whatever the word is, like trying to keep their thing to themselves. Because actually, the more you collaborate and the more open you are, especially in art, it all feeds each other, and then you know, it just makes the whole thing.
I think it's a very like. I mean, it depends of the stage of a career. I understand that. I don't know, Gerhard Richter, like you know. I mean, having one gallery, that's fine. You know, like. But when you're in your 40s or especially in your 30s, having one gallery or like two, I think it can be like, I think it's much better. Like because they all fight for you. The only thing they want is to find new projects so they can get work, and you know, it's fun. So basically, like the more you have, the more projects interesting for you. And every gallery have very different relationship with curators, different places in the world. Like, you know, like have a gallery in Italy. How amazing is this? You know, I can get to projects or go there. Like it's, you know, obviously the best place to do anything.
Eat pasta, yeah.
Behind you right now in your studio, behind we can see like little works. I can see them on the wall. There's some of this kind of series, which I think in the Xavier Hufkins show are called Red Forest, which to me looked like kind of like almost like Los Angeles forest kind of burning or something, or some kind of like fantastical realm. Maybe there's like some kind of fantastical war.
Lord of the Rings
going
or
on.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of a thing. but how difficult is it to paint that kind of red? Because I feel like I remember talking years and years and years ago to John McAllister all about, he used to do a whole series of like burning houses. And isn't it really hard to like paint kind of like flames, or like maybe not for you? I don't know. I always remember it being a kind of like on a skill level. I think like
interesting. I find it like extremely actually fun. It will not be the right word because the subject is a little bit grim, but it's been very exciting because it's like all those like dots and like all the, and it's actually like in terms of the colors, it's only like less colors than some of the other pastels. So the complexity of matching colors, like, you know, in terms of how much red and green and whatever, it's like slightly less complex. So it's a lot more about the fun kind of little marks here and there. I mean, yeah, I've been having a lot of really good time doing those kind of fire paintings, and they're very intense in terms of colors because the pastel have, you know, it's such a rich medium because it's pure pigments. So the red and the yellow, and they're like very, very powerful, and they really started like a new way of working for me, like a more like kind of post-impressionist kind of Monet kind of because they're much more dotty and less graphic than some other work. And I did basically the first forest fire for the show that I had last year in Montreal at the Musée des Beaux-Arts in Montreal. Basically all the show was about, you know, a relationship to nature and environment through art history, and how paintings through the different centuries have been showing how we, you know, like represent nature and how it shows how our relationship and our perception of nature was. And basically at some point there was, I wanted to hang a bunch of Flemish painting of fires and kind of basically like kind of, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah, like the apocalyptic, you know, we always like the apocalyptic is usually a fire or a flood. At the moment, typically it's a flood, but the idea of the flood is an old one, obviously. So basically I felt I'm going to do a fire painting, and it was very clearly inspired by a photo, the first one that I showed. And then from there, like I took more like an archetype of history, like probably like that part of the worlds, but it could also in Asia, they have similar forests that are burning with this similar type of kind of conifer trees.
Which is universal in some ways, yeah.
In some ways, like, I mean, it's a lot of the forest fires have this type of wood, actually, like, because jungles, like, burn slightly, you know, less easily in a way. I mean, still there's forest fires everywhere, obviously, but, you know, in those kind of, like, California, obviously, it needs to be hot and with higher grounds, and those kind of trees are usually growing there. And so when there's a fire, like they really catch on fire, like heavily.
I love the fact that you described, sorry, Rob, I love the fact that you described art as being fun, how you seem to have fun in your studio. And we've spoke to a few artists recently that like, they've said that art for them is hard won. A good painting is a struggle. But I've always found with you, there is this element of absolute joy. I've seen so many Christmas cards, enviously, where you've drawn postcards and birthday cards, and they're beautifully like considered. It's not just a simple line. It's like a real work of Nicholas Party art, and they're gifts, and it feels like art for you is joyful, and it's something that you are incredibly busy, but it just brings you joy. It doesn't feel like something that is like, just to quote myself again, hard won.
I know exactly what you mean. I know I have friends for sure that describe that, and it feels that way. It was never the case for me. It was always, if there's one place that I always want to be, it's in my studio and painting. There's few things, what I will think hard in my practice is definitely not the moment that I that I paint, you know, like it's like some of other part, admin or whatever, that I could find it painful.
Yeah, boring.
But every time I paint, it's never like, I mean, not that it's easy, like every time, no. I mean, of course, sometimes. But I find it like the moment that is hard, and when you deblock something, you know, there's always like a problem that you're trying to resolve. And the every time you kind of like manage, at least you perceive it that you kind of deblock that problem, it's the most satisfying. And like, I mean, you get a lot of like, it's like really kind of sport or something. You really get, it's very addictive.
Wow.
It's like really, and I really love like almost never takes holiday because that's, if I have to choose, that's what I want to do.
That is your
I think you really I think you really feel that in your installations as well. There's such a joy to the way you put it all together. And when I was researching this episode, we actually had a dinner in my house on the weekend for another artist called Daisy Paris, and one of the collectors that was there was Nikki and Robert Wilson from Jupiter. And Nikki said to me that the thing that was really interesting about you was that Nicholas is a demon jigsaw puzzle doer. And apparently you are amazing at putting puzzles together. So like you can have a puzzle, all the hundreds of pieces, and that you're meant to be amazing at like putting them, assembling them and putting them all into an image, which made so much sense to me. Because if you think about your work, it's all these like disparate elements and different mediums and different materials and different ideas that are all quite fantastical as well as being realistic, but they all sort of come together like a puzzle. Yeah. And it was like, your brain must function in a different way.
But also you must love the work if you're going to do murals of that size, and then they're temporary. That's the thing that I don't understand, is that you put all this work in some of these venues and then they're just painted over.
Yeah, but I that's really a part that I love. If they were staying, I will be like, I'm not sure I will do them. Like, I mean, sometimes they stay and I don't really, you know, I don't love it, because it's, you know, an artist already like does so much work that is supposed to, you know, like stay for after you die. And, you know, like artistry is a little bit like those museums, you know, that was painted like 500 years ago and you're still, and that could be a little bit like stressful and haunting. You can be like, oh, and what about if it's shit, you know, like you can like so at least when it's removed,
the impermanence is good. Yeah.
It's very good. It's very, you know, like you do, when you do a mural, you're less stressed because it's going to be removed. So if it's bad, or it's going to be here for a few months, so it's you know, even if people don't like it, it's not a big deal, right? You're just going to like cover it up. And it's the, for me, the murals were always very performative, because I did a lot of graffiti, street art stuff when I was a teenager, and graffiti, you know, like especially the illegal stuff, like, you know, on the train and on the side of the train track and highways and all that, that's, you know, the visual part is really not that important. Like, what is important is to do it. It's to go there at night with your friends and, like, you know, getting chased by the police.
Yeah.
It's like...
What was your tag? Party or something? Let's party.
That's fine. That was, there was a bunch, but there was, like, SEAM, S-E-A-M, that was on train. And we had, like, PM, that was one of the group, but we had, like... It's a long kind of 10 years arc of...
Have you connected with Cause about this? Is Cause
he's a friend of us. We definitely get along with that. That's it's definitely a thing, like skaters or like whatever. Like when you meet someone, you're like, oh, okay, you did it too.
Yeah,
kindred spirits. Yeah. What about puzzles then? When did puzzles come into your life?
I'm not a big. So the reality is more. Nick, they have this incredible house that, you know, if you're lucky enough, like we did, to be hosted by them, which was really, really fantastic, probably my favorite install. Like, and they have a puzzle table, which since then I always wanted to have, and we didn't manage to do it yet. But like, you know, basically there's a table always, you know, in the living room with a puzzle that is there, and they're part of this British Puzzle Society. And this is the coolest thing. It's basically like you get this leather old box with basically a puzzle, but with no image, nothing. And it's like wooden kind of cuts. And it's basically, it's fairly complicated. And you get the pieces, you don't know what the image is. And it's like this little book that you have to register. And then you send it back and it goes to someone else from this. Apparently the Queen is part of this, of that.
The British Puzzle club. Society.
Yeah, and you get the puzzle, and it's really incredible. And you get this old box, and it's busy, and then you do the puzzle without knowing, and then you have this incredible image that you didn't know. And then
you pass it on. Sorry, you recycle it, so someone else gets that puzzle.
Exactly, and you sign, and you can see in the book who did it.
It's like pass the puzzle.
Yeah, and
these puzzles? Are they like?
I don't know. I think they're changing kind of a bit, and there's like a little, like, you know, like a little was like, oh, that was very hard. Like, you know, and you can imagine
the Queen's written her Royal Highness. This is a tough one.
Russ, we can ask Nikki when we interview Nikki, because I really want to do a focus on
what
Nikki
was the image on there. What was it like?
I mean, it was often paintings, I guess. Like, okay. But you know, so, for example, all the time they don't have a straight edge. So the edge could be like ornate. So it's very hard to do. Like, it's really neat. It was just so perfect, because I was doing the mural during the day, and then we'll go in this great little castle that they have, you know, a fireplace and a little drink, and you just do the puzzle, like, so you can have a conversation and you focus your mind.
Yeah, lovely.
Very, very good. I've got recommended.
A couple more questions before we get into our last thing. The first one is, what do you find hard to draw then? If everything it does is joyful and easy, are you like shit at feet or hands?
I'm actually quite bad at all. My craft is very limited, actually. It's going to sound not true, but I'm actually quite lazy, and I don't find it working super hard, because if it's very hard, I usually don't do it. I always try to have pleasure when I do it. So if I paint a horse and I can't do it, I'm going to be like, you know what, I'm just going to paint some trees. It's easier.
Fuck the horse.
And so sometimes I do have I'd love to have this and this and have this vision, I'm going to add those characters and everything. And I start and I'm like, oh my God, this is way too complicated. It will require hours of pain. Exactly. And I don't want to do that. But I think it's in life, it's something that is often important. Just, of course, you have to fight and work hard for where you're going, but also recognize what you have, what you're good at and have fun doing. So you can, have a good time doing whatever you do, because if you choose a sport that you're terrible at and you hate doing and you're going to do it 5 times a week, it's really not going to be fun.
That's true.
Want to choose something that you enjoy doing. It's like the same with people you hang out with, right?
Well, if you love your job, you never work a day in your life. Isn't that what they say?
Exactly, yeah.
I want to know about printmaking and how important printmaking is for you, because it's something that when I first discovered your work, you'd made a suite of prints as a fundraiser for Glasgow. And hopefully we're working on a project together soon. And prints, you've done a lot of fundraising prints. It's a very generous act that you've done for the Whitechapel. I think I've seen some. And how important is printmaking to you? And do you have a rule? Because I think most of the prints I've seen of yours have been black and white. They've been monochrome. I don't think I've seen many color ones.
I did screen prints. Screen print, they're usually in colors. So right. I did the woodcut for the Urshan Museum. Fundraising. That was very Japanese looking kind of woodcuts in colors. But yeah, I do actually kind of think that photography and printing for me is kind of black and white. It's kind of I think they're very powerful to kind of capture that very specific idea of black and white, which is a very strange idea of consuming an image. And history of printmaking is kind of black and white. In the West, for sure. Yeah. In Japan, it's very different. And I've been doing a lot of woodcuts recently, and before that, mezzotint. But so woodcut, I'm a big fan of Félix Vallotton, kind of the Swiss-French artist that did a lot of woodcuts. So that's how I get. And it's kind of actually the puzzle thing. It's like printmaking, especially woodcuts. You do your image, and then you have to carve the block, right? And this basically this part, which can take a long time, is purely technical. There's absolutely nothing creative about it. You just have to be extremely focused, because if you break anything, it's done. You have to restart from scratch. So and I love that. I don't do that every day at all, but I love sometimes to be today I'm going to carve this wood and I'm not going to think about it. Because when you do a painting, this moment that is it, I'm not usually going to use the word hard, but it's oh my God, it's obviously not working and I need to resolve the problem. Mm-hmm. And something is completely off. With a woodcut, when you start to do it, it's purely technical. You just only have to be focused with your hands, stay calm, put your headphones, listen to talk art.
And yes, it's all you need. Yeah.
You can do an entire season in one block. To be honest, I'd love to do much more printmaking, but funny enough, it's much longer to do than painting, because it's the whole process, and then you have to print it. It's a good relationship with the printer. You have to go there, you have to do test proof. It's painting, when you're fairly kind of classic painters like I am, it's very straightforward. You sketch, you paint, you by yourself, you can do whatever. It's very, the production side is very simple. Anytime you do sculptures, for example, it's becoming a nightmare, and every sculptor will probably tell you, Hugo Mordino or whatever, the line of technical problems that you have when you produce objects, it's with material, is how they transport it, how they come to the studio. It's an entire, Carol Bove has a studio down the road here. It's, I can tell you it's a different operation than here. it's complicated. Here it's very my studio is super simple. I have different little rooms, and my studio, here when I'm right now, it's when I do my actually, that's where the do my little woodcuts.
And we're looking at a lot of prints and drawings now in your studio. And this is New York we're currently talking to you from.
Yeah, and then actually that's my little oil and copper that I do here. So this room here, it's like the little room where I do little work. And the room next door is where I do like my pastel. And then the rest of the rooms are more like kind of like for hanging things and everything.
That was something Russell was interested in asking, actually, was this idea of like, do you just do one work at a time? But in that room, you're like surrounded by probably like 40 works. I mean, small works, but so it's like all these ideas are kind of
pouring out.
Flowing around.
I do a lot of sketches. So I do like sketches and then I put them like, I do like I see that's the sketches that I've been doing like when I was in the States, mountains.
Love those metal. Yeah, we got.
Did you always draw? Did you start drawing when you were a kid?
As I said, every kids are drawing. People always say like, oh, every kids are drawing. Like, I don't know any kids that will not, because that's what they do at school. They literally, because they can't really like sit down and like, you know, oh, let's just like do some math.
Yeah.
They have to play, and you know, like play with clay, play with sand, play with paints. But so like you, and again, the only thing that you do if you're an artist, you just keep doing it. That's the only difference.
Do you feel part of the community there in New York? I know you've curated, I saw a project at the Flag Art Foundation, which you did, which is incredible, with amazing artists in. Do you feel like you're in a dynamic artistic community there? Because whenever I go to New York, I love it because I feel like I'm really connected to like movements.
Yeah, I can't claim because some of my friends are much more connected, and I have a little bit of a working problem, as you maybe can see. Like, I'm kind of always trying to be in my studio, and I don't even call that working, but I'm like really kind of, but of course, you know, I'm in New York, so I go to openings, and I have like three galleries here. So Karma has a very strong community of artists, and they're really great with their like dinners and like, so you know, and also of course like Kaufman Repetto also, and Hauser, it's a little bit more like a big thing, so it's maybe it's like a very tight community. But to be honest, like with Hauser, like you're gonna meet, you know, I met Cindy Sherman, and I mean, you meet obviously amazing people because they have a pretty good network of artists they work with, and you know, it's kind of pretty incredible. Like I met like amazing artists, but of course I have like friends, and most of them are artists, and we kind of hang out. But I will not say, because definitely there is people that have a very strong artist community. Actually, the people that I did, some people that I did the show with at Flag Art, like, you know, Loy Olowell, Robin Williams, they're I feel like they have a pretty tight community of people. Like they kind of do studio visits, and like I don't do much of that. Sure. Like, but of course, I mean, being in New York, like I see artists like three times a week, because it's like every time you go out there, and also the people that work with me here are artists too. So like, and some of them are much more kind of a bit younger, so much more connected, like more knowing what exactly what's going on.
Everywhere you go is a bloody artist. Yes.
Yeah.
So final questions then. So, if you could do an art heist, if you could have any work of art for yourself, I don't know if you are a collector, what would it be and why?
I do collect actually quite a lot.
Oh, right, great.
So, yeah, that's probably where I spend the most money, for sure.
Same. What do you collect?
I collect everything that I love, I'm trying to get. So, of course, there's things that I can't get. But typically, like Otto Marcus van Schreck, this Dutch painter from, you know, like 1600s, that was like a very kind of famous artist at the time. But I discovered him in an auction site, and I bought a painting, and then I made like an entire show at Hauser, actually in LA. And I bought another one of his painting at Sotheby's in New York. So there's like two, you know, it could go from like 1630 Flemish kind of painting. They're both in my studio right now. I've been buying two Rosalba Carriera, which is like the queen of pastel. She's like really the most influential pastel artist in the kind of early kind of 18th century. So, you know, it could be that if I could have like a piece of anything, well, it's impossible to obviously answer, but I try to borrow, you know, there was this amazing sale of Jojo O'Keeffe like a few years ago at Sotheby's, and I tried to get like, it was a tiny painting. There was great drawings. I didn't get anything. It's kind of stupid. I think I bet on the wrong, I was too ambitious, and obviously it was completely out of my league, but I tried a few times. But there was a little like kind of like fruits kind of painting that was really, but I love her work, and I will be like, I mean, but, you know, that's a bit upscale, obviously. But, I mean, you know, I went to the, I was in Paris a few weeks ago, and I went to the John Mitchell and Claude Monet painting show. And the late Claude Monet, I was like, those are delicious.
So a late Claude Monet or the George O'Keefe that you lost at Sotheby's a few years ago, we'll get you those. Would you be happy with that?
Yeah. I can name you 100 other ones, but...
I love that, because you're a proper collector. I love that you've answered it as someone
my phone is full of like saved thing and like, you know, like, I have one Félix Vallotton painting, but I want to buy another one. I mean, this one is like really like hundreds of, basically I'm trying to buy like whatever. I bought like two Jean van Kessel painting on copper, for example, but the problem with old stuff, you never really know if it's really like what it is, but
yeah, when it's a few hundred years old, yeah, it's a bit.
Yeah, the provenance is the key to success with old stuff, and sometimes those things are not very. The provenance is very blurry.
If the provenance says acquired from the artist by the present owner, and it's from 1600, then you definitely know that it's not legit. That's just my tip.
Also, yeah, exactly. I want to say that also obviously buy some contemporary art, because you're going to think like, this guy is only buying like things in the... Because I have like a great kind of Monster Chetwin in my studio right here.
Oh, nice.
And I have the bats, like...
the Bat Opera, yeah.
The Bat Opera.
I love that series.
She's awesome.
Russ and I saw that show.
I do buy like quite often from the gallery that I work with, like from Kaufman Repetto, like, you know, because they have like obviously artists that I know that I love, and you know, so that's kind of, and it's like the flow of exchange is great, and I work with amazing galleries that have really incredible artists, so it's kind of like with Karma, I got this great, you know, like sadly passed Matthew Wong, but I have a really great painting that is also, I mean, actually a lot of my art is in my studio. In the office kind of space, there's nothing of mine there. So like there's a bit of fresh air, especially for people that work here. So they're not like surrounded by my stuff all day long. Like they can have like a little break. And me too, actually, sometimes. I don't have any of my work at home or anything, obviously, because I see that all day long. It's enough.
Got it.
The other question we ask is, what is your favorite color?
Well... I mean, pink is kind of my favorite color, but it's weirdly like, I have a mustardy yellow that I use almost all the time.
Yes.
That I love, and it goes great with pink. But somehow lately, I'm really into yellows, like, but it's yellow is kind of hard, but also kind of especially for interiors and everything. But pink and this, actually kind of a bit of a millennium kind of pink, I'm sorry to say. It's very obvious. Like, but I love, you know, there was this, like, I guess this, like, catalog.
Own catalog, yeah.
Yeah, so that pink I love is the older.
So we're looking at a photograph of your pastel storage cabinet, which is...
Rainbow.
It looks
colors.
Like a Gursky photograph.
Yeah.
The pink you like makes me think of like Marie Antoinette or something.
Oh yeah, but that's the Rococo, because I'm a big Rococo fan, because of the best. See, that's the,
oh wow, look at that. Can you send us a photograph of that and we can post that for everyone? That looks...
Of course, yeah. I'm gonna show you.
Well, there's actually an amazing portrait of you, I think, somewhere I've seen before, where it's
in front
you,
of all the pastels.
In front of it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, is it all the cameras? I'm showing you guys my favorite colour. Oh, you
who makes your pastels?
My pastels are made by three manufacturers, like Rocher from Paris, Saint-Hélier from Paris, and Unison from the UK, actually. They're all very different brands, actually, and the Rocher from Paris is kind of a very high-end, amazing pigments pastel. That's, I mean, they're really incredible. They're really very special. They're all handmade by two people.
Oh, my God. How much do you spend on pastels a year, do you think, Nicholas?
I definitely can know that. This someone back there that knows exactly that answer.
Like,
I mean, for sure, like, for sure. I mean, you know, it's compared to like some expenses, again, for sculptures, it's not crazy, but like probably 10,000, 15,000 probably. But that will include maybe some of the murals. I don't know. Because like, I think with the canvas, definitely not that much. But when you do a mural with pastel, that's like goes pretty quickly.
Yeah, do you ever get and like wrist injuries or anything? Have you ever got like tennis elbow or RSI because
repetitive strain
stuff?
No, what you have with mural with pastel, I had that many times. It's because the pastel has to have a kind of an abrasive, like a kind of sandpaper surface, so it holds on the canvas on the wall. Mm. So, and you use your hand, right? You kind of rub the pastel. So you, when you do a big mural, you rub your hand on the sandpaper all day long. So, you know, you kind of start to bleed on your finger. which is it's a bit annoying.
So some of these murals have Nicholas Party's blood in them.
Blood.
All of them, probably.
All of them.
Sweat and tears.
The one that I made in pastel anyway. Like, but a mural in pastel is by far, like, it's really amazing because it's matte. You know, murals in acrylic or oil paints or whatever, like, I mean, you can, it's very hard, but like, basically, you know, like with the whatever light you have in the space, you're going to have a sheen very often. And it's, you know, when you take a photo or whatever, it's very hard with a large scale mural. With pastel, like it, because it doesn't reflect any light because it's so velvety matte. It's actually amazing in space. It's really like incredible.
What's something that you haven't done yet that you really would love to realize? Like, is there a big ambition, like a kind of burning like desire to create something that you haven't quite done yet? Because I feel like you've achieved so much at such a young age. But every time I see a new show by you, you always take it somewhere new. Like even the burning, you know, forests or whatever, like that, there's always this kind of new element to what you're doing. Like, is there something that's like a big desire for you?
I mean, it was never like, I mean, I think when you start, like, you know, your journey into your art, you definitely have this, like, I want to work with a gallery. So, you know, that I did. And then you kind of like, I want to do like few big shows, and I have like in museums or whatever to see how it feels to do like, you know, a large, like the one I did in Montreal or in Lugano, like with the catalog and everything. And and that's, you know, it's, if I didn't do that, I would be like, I'd love to try to see how it feels to work with a big, I mean, I definitely want to keep doing those because they're really great, and it's more like a long kind of, usually it takes a few years to do. And there's like great project coming up like that I'm very excited. But I think like actually like if I were to say like, oh, if there's one thing that I want to, it's just being in the studio and like discovering new little thing. But it's not like a big thing. It's really like, oh, like I have like, I think artists usually have like, it's not an image, it's like a feeling, an intuition of like they know it's going somewhere, and they know that they're going to meet, you know, when I met my characters, the pastel portraits, that's an incredible moment for an artist, I feel, like for me anyway. It was really, and I did, when I did the fire, the same, it's like suddenly you, it's really like meeting someone amazing, new, in a, you know, in a party or whatever, and you're going to, you know, like fall in love, and you're going to hang out, and you're going to be like, wow, we have a lot of things to say to each other. It's, so I think if I have to, one thing that I really want is not losing that. I don't want to be like in few years time, not meeting anybody in my studio. I mean, if I like, oh, because some of the subjects at some point, like the fruits that I did for a few years now, like basically we don't have anything to say to each other. So I don't paint them. I live with photos of them. I mean, photos like the real one, but we don't, you know, we don't interact with me touching them, making them. They're like more like distance kind of memories now. And that is kind of a scary, when it happens, it's great, but also it's a little bit sad because you like feel like I don't have to say anything to them anymore. They don't have to, if I was doing a fruit now, they would look exactly the same as the one that I did like a year and a half ago. They don't change anymore.
Yeah, you've kind of exhausted it.
Yeah, yeah, we don't have to, you know, it's like a relationship, right? At some point you're like, you're in a restaurant and you're like, you know what, maybe we don't have to.
We should break up. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe when you're like 80 or something, you'll like rediscover something. Like there'll be a theme and suddenly you'll have a new love again.
New fruits, exactly. Yeah, that will be, that's like, but you know, like
the return of the fruit.
But and it's you know, when you like look at those greats, you know, great artist figure, like again, like the Monet show and Mitchell at the Vuitton, and you see those late paintings. You know, I mean, Hockney is a very famous character for that because he feels like every other year he's coming up with his, like, you know, that's another very enthusiastic, obviously, artist that, and he's like, seems like he met again new subjects, new techniques, and he's like fresh as like, you know, when he was like 20 or 30 in California. Like, and that's, I think the only thing that an artist wants is to keep that, because if you don't have that, that is a very scary path, because like, you know, artists are completely addicted, you know, we're addicted to that relationship with things. And if you don't feed the machine, I think you get like, it's a scary kind of kind of like space that you're trying to never go, basically, because I will have no idea what to do, basically.
What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
I mean, probably like, I mean, at school, I definitely got great advice of trying to let the work talk to you, and the audience trust the work. you know, like I think I was told often, like at school anyway, like to let the work talk for itself. Because I feel like if that's why I was saying, you know, like early on before we got started the interview, like I never really listen or my interviews or reread them because I felt like, oh my God, this is so stupid. If my art is like that, I'm going to stop right now. But like, so like I would say, like, I'll let, like I always hope that the art is more complex and more interesting than myself. And I think like, I believe every artist probably feels the same. Like they're like, they feel like the language of what we use, like, you know, shapes and colors and symbolic images, it brings a complexity that we can't express with words or like, you know, like, and I think like trusting that makes you like less stressed in the studio because you feel like, again, sometimes you feel like maybe I'm like stupid. So I can't really make art because I'm like, I read my, well, you know, whatever, like, and I feel, but trust the image that you're making. If it goes really smoothly out of yourself, whatever life you're living, whatever you've been, it could be really great. Like it's, you know, you don't have to have a crazy life, or you can, it doesn't matter. Like, but I think art's, you know, every existence is completely, you know, great by itself. Like there's not an individual on earth that don't have everybody like that I observe in my window, there's like a big New York kind of view, could be an amazing, you know, novel, probably their life. Mm-hmm. So like if you can put that into art, like what, you know, like sometimes you're like, oh, my life maybe is a bit boring, or Monet, actually going back to Monet was famously very boring in his life, in his entry, in his kind of diary, because it's the only thing that he talks about is the weather, because he's constantly looking at when he's going to go out and when the light's going to be okay to go out. So like his entire life was like, today it's a little bit too cold, I can't paint, very like, right. And but the work is like, you know, transcend like so much.
So he's addicted, like you're saying, that's definitely an addicted artist. Everything just boils down to the ability to make art.
Yeah, I think artists are addicted to this. I don't know why we are, but we are.
Well, we're addicted to you, Nicholas. This has been an incredible feature length, I'm going to say, episode, because we've talked for
we
a
love
long
you so
time.
Much,
but this has been,
and we've waited a long time to talk to you, so we had a lot of questions.
Thank you so much. And I'm excited for us to work together on an upcoming print, which we can announce soon. But that's very brilliant. And again, a big fundraiser.
And actually, it'll be made here in Margate.
That's right.
In
so
Kent. Yeah.
That's going to be great. And currently, I think this comes out, and there might be a few days left to catch Cascade. If you're in Brussels, it's Xavier Hufkens, but obviously go on Xavier Hufkens' website. As you said, you've got all of those galleries there. Everyone can find your work. I don't know if you have a website, but I know you're active on Instagram because that's how we connected.
Yeah, a little bit. Not super active, but I'm trying.
And that's at Nicholas Party, without a H, Nicolas Party. We will be posting images.
Yeah, and the show Cascades runs until the 4th of March, so get there. Otherwise, you have to look at it online and just imagine what it was like to stand in front of those paintings. We'll be back very soon.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, Andish. I love the show, and thanks for doing it. It's really great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll be back very soon. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.